Welcome to the Divorce Podcast, where we explore all aspects of ending relationships, separation, and parenting apart. If your marriage or partnership has ended, or you have friends and family who are separating, this podcast is for you. I'm Kate Daly, a relationship counsellor, divorce specialist, and co-founder of Amicable, the online legal service for separating couples. In each episode, we look at relationships and separation from different angles, including the emotional, legal, and social. I'm joined by experts and special guests who share their own unique stories, experience, and tips with the goal of helping people end relationships in a kinder and better way. In this episode, I was joined by Paul Huntingford, an integrative therapist working in private practice. Paul is passionate about group work and increasing access to psychological support around divorce and separation. His own experience of divorce led him to retrain as a therapist, having previously worked in sports and healthcare settings. We began this episode by looking at how Paul's separation impacted his mental health when things went sour after the involvement of solicitors, ultimately leading to a complete breakdown in communication between Paul and his ex. We talked about the role that shame and guilt played in his separation and the trickiness of navigating the emotional journey. It's great to see how Paul has used his own experience of divorce to help others move through their own separation and deal with their own emotional journeys. If you loved this episode, then please subscribe and rate us on your preferred listening platform. It's lovely to have you. Welcome, Paul.
Okay, good to be here.
Thank you for joining us. And what an interesting background you have. And it's also kind of interesting to see that it was your own divorce that kind of led you into this area. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about that, how you came to be a coach and the impact that your own personal divorce had on that journey?
My marriage wasn't really conventional. There was shades of coercive control, domestic abuse. It was very traumatic. And so when I left that marriage, there was a lot for me to process and a lot for me to kind of look back on. And that's kind of where my therapy journey started. So I was doing more exploration within, well, it wasn't where my therapy journey started because something happened in my earlier life, but this was what kind of another stage of it. And so I was working as a PT and doing my therapy and negotiating the end of this relationship, which when we split, we had these meetings. Once I'd moved out of the flat, we had these meetings where we were kind of sitting on benches crying. It was kind of very cinematic, going, oh, this is going to be the most caring, compassionate breakup. You know, conscious uncoupling was big at the time. We're going to consciously uncouple and do all those things. And that's how we left it. And that's actually the last time I saw my wife, ex-wife physically. And after that, she was living in what was my flat. And I was saying, okay, you can say that our marriage was only 3 years. So it was a very short marriage. And the agreement was that after she stayed in there for 3 months and trying to find out, then we'd move out, we'd uncouple and get on with it, which happened. But then after in December, I'd kind of been putting my head in the sand about the divorce and separation. And I was just kind of hoping it would go away and it would happen very easily. But then suddenly the divorce proceedings were launched. It was very nasty. It was pretty brutal and it was very expensive and needlessly so. And because of certain things that were said, I couldn't have contact or didn't, my lawyer said, don't have contact. So it got very adversarial very quickly. And in my mind, it didn't need to be that way. And so that's where it went. And that process went on for 2 years after that of being quite brutal, unnecessary. And again, trauma from beyond the marriage, I would say.
And it's such a common theme, the stuff you're talking about. And here, lots of people say the same thing, where they have all the good intention of wanting to start a process amicably and very, as you say, that whole conscious uncoupling and thinking about it in a, let's leave this with some dignity. What happened then for it to not sort of play out in that way, would you say? What went wrong?
I have no idea because I did not speak to her, but I think it just became about finances really. And about, there was maybe, you know, the fact that we weren't in connection anymore and it kind of gave space for some resentment to build. You know, I have no doubt she was, you know, entitled to some money. There was that, but I am absolutely fine with that because we were married. We were a couple. That was part of, you know, we were together for 3 years. But it became about I suppose, security. And, you know, I was very triggered by that in terms of, because it was my home as well. And it felt I'd been in there for kind of 10 years on my own or living with friends. And it was pretty destabilizing, I'd say. I don't know whether or not she spoke to someone, or I don't know. I can't really say what went on for her. What went on for me, which I wouldn't, was that I put my head in the sand and I didn't actually address what I knew the issue was. If I could go back, I'd start going, okay, right, we need to do this from the start and actually do this rather than just hope it's going to go away.
So it sounds like you are missing a process that enabled you to feel safe enough to raise issues and actually sort of confront them and discuss them in a sort of held and safe environment.
Absolutely. And that is what you've just said there, is what wasn't happening in the marriage at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, it didn't feel like that. It felt like when there was an issue raised, it would be very combative, and it was not easy to do that. And so I think part of my restraint afterwards was, again, wondering whether all that was going to happen.
And, you know, you were just talking then as well about, you know, the fact that you were already in therapy, and it sounds like that having somebody to go to and during that process enabled you to create some kind of reflection on what you were going through, and that then enabled you to start to think more broadly about the support and help people going through this kind of thing actually need and would benefit from. Is that fair enough? Tell us about that, how you went from being in therapy. As you say, you were in therapy, you had a marriage that you were navigating the ending of, you were working as a personal trainer. What then happened where you created enough space to say, actually, you know what, I want to go into this world, having just come through the trauma of it, I want to get back into it and help people?
Well, I think I was already in a job where I was helping people, and I'd already done quite a lot of work on myself. And I'd always been interested in the mental change more than the physical change. I was kind of, I loved that part of the job. And I suppose going into this exploration through the marriage, and, you know, I found out, In my first therapy session, actually, I kind of realized, oh, I'd married a version of my dad, you know, was essentially what I came out. And that was like a light bulb moment, but it didn't cause me to leave the marriage. And I suppose ever after that, it was kind of looking at what was going on in many, it wasn't just therapy, one-to-one therapy, you know, I went to other groups as well. And I think I just always, I know it's helped me so much, kind of exploring that side of myself and grow as a human being. And I love seeing that change in other people and to be there. And I think what I've noticed about divorce is that it's something that's not really spoken about, that people don't want to speak about, or it gets very kind of, it's about the facts. It's about speaking to lawyers. It's about the organization for the kids. It's about all these kind of facty things. And there's not actually that much done about the kind of feelings which are huge, which are going on. And it can be just related to what's going on in the here and now of the marriage, but it can also be, as it was in my case, related to stuff going on from my childhood, which I was working out through the dynamic of the marriage and was coming out. And I think I didn't have a plan that this was where I was going to be. I just kind of followed my interest and went one step at a time and go, okay, this will help me be a better trainer at the time. I'll be on the journey. And actually going through the journey, I kind of learned more about myself, did more kind of psychotherapy groups and all those kind of things. And those were always the things where one-to-one therapy is great. You get a deep understanding of yourself, but there's something about the process that happens in a group with others that is incredibly healing. It's quite confrontational as well, you know, puts you up against your kind of barriers and takes some courage to kind of step into, but they kind of supercharged the kind of therapy experience and the kind of recovery experience, I think, for me.
Wow. You mentioned just then this notion of effectively what we say is divorce is an emotional journey with legal and financial consequences. But today, because it's sat in the legal services sector, it's always been treated as a legal process or a financial process, as you say. So I'm with you on that. I think that exploration of what the emotional journey is incredibly important, because ultimately I think that's what dictates whether a divorce is difficult or not. You know, we see lots of people with all different kinds of financial circumstances. It's rarely the complexity of their finances that makes for a difficult divorce. It's usually the complexity of the emotional journey for either one or both of them, or the interplay between their two personal journeys, that's the key to all of this. So I think you're right. very little is spoken about. And I wonder if that leads on to one of the other things, you know, I was really keen to, you know, talk to you about today, which is this idea of shame and guilt in divorce. And you mentioned the shame word earlier. So just let's start by just unpacking that a little bit. What is shame to start with? And then let's look at the shame that's involved in divorce.
Shame is about how we feel about ourselves. And it tends to be a bit of a judgment. You know, when it becomes kind of toxic, it might be, I'm a bad person, I'm worthless, I'm a failure around the marriage, or I haven't been a success, or I'm a bad dad, or whatever it might be. And then this can come into how we feel about ourselves. And it will come with a feeling, which tends to be a sinking stomach, a kind of slumping of the shoulders, a bit of an isolation, feeling that you don't fit into the group. And a big part of shame is actually not feeling part of the group and how we feel that other people feel about us. It's not necessarily what we've done. It's about how we feel about ourselves and how other people feel about us. And it can be really destructive. And I think there's a lot about the divorce process and the separation process that just emphasizes shame. It kind of makes the conditions perfect for shame to kind of grow and be there. And actually a lot of what we do in society and how we deal with it, you know, have friends and family deal with it, can accelerate that in some ways too.
Yeah. And I think often when a relationship breaks down, there is criticism involved. Even when you're trying your best not to be overtly critical of somebody else, there's an implicit criticism. And I just wonder whether in a divorce, shame is that internalization of that criticism as well, isn't it? That makes you feel like, you say, you get those globalized thoughts, I'm rubbish at everything, I'm a failure at relationships, and you sort of globalize out the particular troubles or struggles you're having within a very specific context to be much bigger than that. And you feel a sense of shame for that, for what you perceive as a failure. But relationship breakdown doesn't always have to be about failure, does it?
No, it doesn't have to be about a failure. It can be about the kind of joys that you've had together and how you've grown together. And in fact, actually, you know, as difficult as my marriage was, I have definitely learned from it. And, you know, it was incredibly painful at the time, but over the years, I've managed to see, okay, actually, how has that made me grow as a person and as a human being? And in terms of my personal relationships now, they're very different to how they were before I was in that relationship. And also, it's about being grateful for what has happened within the relationship that it has still been there. Okay, the relationship might not be there, but what is still there? You know, what has been there through that relationship?
There's some research from the King's Fund talking about the fact that in England and Wales or Great Britain, we are now less worried about divorce than many other countries. We have a much more liberal and, you know, socially acceptable attitude towards divorce. I think it's something like over 50% of people think divorce is an acceptable, normal part of life. But it still feels like there's a bit of a way to go yet, doesn't there? What do you think is the issue with divorce still in terms of from a shame perspective? Why do people still feel, and I include myself in this, why do we still feel kind of ashamed?
Well, I think it's almost a natural, as I said, it's kind of a natural part of the process. If we think about divorce as being, you know, part of being part of a social group, and we've got the family unit, which is our social group, and we've got friends around the family unit. And when that separation happens, very rarely is it going to be completely fine. You know, some friends will go off, you'll lose some friends, you'll be rejected from some groups, not invited to some parties and invited. And that will naturally have an effect on what was our normal. And so there's a natural part of that kind of, I'm not saying it's shaming, but it will just increases the chances of that kind of growing. And, you know, what happens a lot of the time is that it isn't that ideal. And there are conflicting divorces that cause even more and drive even more problems. And yeah, that kind of just amplifies it all.
And I guess shame is relative, isn't it? Because it's relative to the sort of social norms that we hold. And as our social norms move, you would kind of expect that people to feel less shame. For example, if the study is to be believed and divorce is becoming more socially acceptable, you would expect the shame element to go down. Yet when I talk to people, it doesn't feel like that quite happens. There's still a lot of internalization of self-blame, self-criticism, and negative self-perception that comes through. And I'm just wondering, how could we treat divorce and separation differently? What could we do as professionals to help reduce that shame count? Because it just feels like it still weighs on people very heavily.
I think the big one is kind of, you know, in terms of how I work with shame therapeutically, is trying to build self-compassion around what's gone on. And that's where I would go to in terms of helping anyone. It's how do we build that, make this as compassionate as possible for people going through this process, and also encourage them to learn how to be more compassionate on themselves, because there will be things that people are being hard on themselves about. And it's how do you build that, you know, to go back to my training days, build that muscle of compassion, so that actually when you notice that actually you're going hard in on yourself, is actually, okay, right, how do I treat myself with kindness at this moment, rather than jump on that bandwagon? And that takes, it takes skill, and it takes a bit of practice as well.
And ultimately, I guess the other thing is you need your kind of self-esteem rebuilding. You need it to be higher if you're navigating that whole process of divorce and separation. Because as you mentioned earlier, when you do get down to the nitty-gritty practical things, to negotiate those kind of settlements and agreements, you've got to be in a good place. And you need to kind of think of rebuilding your self-esteem and yourself through this process at the earliest opportunity, don't you? So this idea that you should, it's never too early to start on that therapeutic journey, I think is quite key, isn't it? You need those therapeutic, that therapeutic support to sit alongside your journey rather than come at the end of it when you've got time to process. Because I know that sometimes something we hear a lot, people saying, well, I'll do the therapy at the end. But I always think to myself, gosh, if you start now, you'll have that support as you go through making those real life-changing decisions.
Definitely. I mean, I don't know whether therapy is for absolutely everyone, but it might be that, but I certainly think that actually looking for support around this time is the key thing. Like if you're trying to go through this all on your own, then please, you know, speak to someone else. And, but I, you know, I think there are lots of different options out there for kind of connecting with other people. And as you say, kind of building that self-esteem, getting support around this, which it can be very easy to miss or deprioritize when you're going through, okay, I've got to do this. And there are a lot of things which have to get done, right, to get you through the process.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit now about guilt. Tell me, first of all, just explain for everybody listening, what's guilt?
So guilt is regret about something that has been done. So it may be regretting leaving the marriage or regretting having an affair or something, rather than I'm a bad person because. It is a physical feeling as well, because it's actually the physical feeling of guilt is very similar to the feeling of shame, but it's definitely a little bit more cognitive, I suppose. And kind of, oh, if I fix this, whereas shame is, I am a bad person. And that's the end of that. Guilt is, if I could go back, I'd fix it. So there's an element of how can I work my way out of this with guilt.
Guilt feels like a bit of a trap to me, because the chances of being able to go back and fix things are usually zero.
Exactly. It's a complete trap.
How do you work with guilt in a therapeutic process when somebody is divorcing? Then what sort of strategies can you give people to help them overcome guilt if that's how they're feeling during their divorce or separation?
A lot of guilt tends to be rumination, right? Ruminating on thoughts of things I should have done, I should have done this. And I'm a big one for kind of journaling or writing letters that you never send, and kind of getting through that process. And it doesn't fix the process, but actually if it can kind of let go of some of those loops of thought that are going on, it can help. And then other mindfulness techniques, because the guilt tends to be cyclical, is going around and around. Okay, I should have done this. What happened if I did this? And actually, as you say, it's a trap. You never get anywhere with that. The chance of being able to fix that is nothing. And actually, if you can bring yourself back into the present moment and, you know, come back to center rather than get swept off into the past, there's a chance of being able to find a way forward and detach from that guilty thought, that guilty feeling. And again, that's practice and becoming more aware of what's going on. The problem is, of course, like in a divorce, everything, you have those stages, and you'll get a letter from a lawyer and then boom, okay. And then it all comes up again. And so it's kind of constant work. You get to the end of one bit and then, okay, I've got to do another bit, and it will bring up more stuff.
I like what you say about it really coming down to the ability to be able to spot the intrusive thoughts, to acknowledge that they're there, and then to hold them and to bring yourself away from them, isn't it? So it's not that they ever necessarily go away, but as you say, you become much more skilled and a lot better at not following them down that endless loop and going round and round and round. Because I used to find that when I was going through my divorce, and it always used to get me when I'd be drying my hair in the morning. So I'd be drying my hair and I'd be re-going over things I wish I'd said and done. And just and I just was totally unconscious of that happening. But everybody will have their own little moments when it happens. And for me, it was always first thing in the morning. And then I'm sort of sat with all of that first thing in the morning as I'm going off to do my day. And I just, it took me ages to appreciate that I could control whether or not I went down that loop, and I had to become really present, as you say, and able to then spot, grab them, put them somewhere else. And all right, you can come back to them at a certain point, but at a time of your choosing rather than it hijacking your day. So I hear that. I hear that a lot.
Yeah, mine was 3 o'clock in the morning. So yeah.
At least I was awake. Yeah. So when you're working with somebody who's processing a divorce, what are the other common things that you think people are really well advised to pay attention to and to work through?
The big one is kind of communication, I would say. Communication with others. Like, if they're still communicating with their ex, how do they communicate with their ex? If they're communicating with the kids, how do they communicate with the kids? What's their motivation? Where are the boundaries are between what they share and what they don't? And that's kind of I think with all relationships, it comes down to communication with the other. And that involves like working with what their feelings are, like becoming better at being able to identify what their feelings are. So they're not just acting on instinct and going, you know, and getting angry or whatever it might be and releasing that straight away. It's actually, okay, what's going on? Okay, this is happening. How do I then communicate that in a way that's not inflammatory or whatever's going on?
I always think with communication as well, it's really the underlying emotions that drive the communication, isn't it? So if your communication is missing the mark, if it's failing, it's often because there's something else underneath a really strong emotion that hasn't been addressed. And, you know, often it's fear. There's a real fear that kind of makes people, if you will, become a bit more aggressive or a bit more pushy than they perhaps want to be. But they're so frightened of either losing something or not having something or being sort of cast out or free falling or whatever it is, that their communication takes on a much more hostile edge. And it's not because they are feeling hostile or angry. It's often because there's this big fear running underneath, and sort of trying to get to the bottom of that fear and getting people to surface it and own it, and then looking at strategies for how to deal with some of those feared outcomes. That feels to me like a lot of the work that we end up doing in this space.
Mm. Well, absolutely. I mean, fear is the anger is the defense mechanism for that threat. And yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Do you think different kinds of relationships, you know, different kind of relationship breakdowns rather, are more likely to lead to certain emotions? So, the one I'm thinking about is if you're on the receiving end of your partner having had an affair, is that going to inevitably lead down a pathway? Or are emotions more complex? Are they more rooted in previous experience? Does the type of breakup dictate the emotional journey, or is it something more subtle and nuanced than that?
I would say probably a little bit more subtle and nuanced than that, because everyone's got their own individual history to get to that point. And actually what their reaction is to an affair, or, you know, the imagined what the reaction might be, but actually it might not happen for a while, or it might be stuck, or there's shock, or what other reactions may happen. And I think everyone has their own, you know, quite a common thing in therapy is actually, well, I'm not feeling what I'm supposed to be feeling. I'm not feeling that grief. Or when am I going to get angry? Or, you know, and actually, it's just the way it is right now. And just let whatever, where you are is fine for now. And it's just letting that be and letting whatever comes up and then being able to react to it when it does. And I think that's what's important, rather than thinking, I've got to process this now. I've got to let this go. And it's, well, that would be great, yes, but that's not where you are right now. So let's work with that.
Yeah, again, I remember that in my first divorce. I've been divorced twice. So I remember that in my first divorce, I didn't feel the sadness. I was just like thinking, God, I don't feel the sadness. This is bad. I don't feel the sadness. I'm just walking around. I don't feel the sadness. What's happening with me? Just, am I some cold and callous person? I don't feel sad. And it took a very long time, a couple of years for that actually to kick in. And that feeling of not following the pattern of how you're supposed to feel was really quite prevalent. It's very strange.
I'll give you an example from my history. I was in this relationship and I was actually very relieved to get out of the marriage. And then I quite quickly got into another relationship, probably about 4 months after having a break. And within 3 months, I was kind of fast forwarded into a very similar dynamic that was going on in my marriage. And it was scary. It was very scary. And I then decided, right, I've really got to concentrate on what I'm actually doing to kind of work through whatever is going on so I can change what I'm doing. Because I was, you know, the old adage, if you keep doing the same thing, you'll make the same mistakes or whatever one it was. But that's what it felt like. And I've had that repetition again. It's the kind of Freudian repetition compulsion of doing the same thing that we're just programmed to do because we have a set way of being in relationships. And actually, if we don't, process is a funny word, what does that mean? But if we don't work out what we're doing, what's going on for us, and then how to express it and also set our boundaries and all the things that we maybe struggle with in relationships, then the chances are something similar is going to happen again. Or we're going to not really be in tune with who we are as a human being and how we then respond to other people. So I advise people to kind of definitely, if something's gone wrong, to look at themselves as well as, you know, what's gone on in the other side of the marriage.
And, you know, I think that that's really important because you can't control the other person, whether it's your ex or the new Mr. or Mrs., whoever you're going to meet. You have no control over that. What you do have control over is insight into yourself, your behaviors, the things that are likely to trigger you, the traps that you're likely to fall into. So when you talk about it in those terms, the end of a relationship, of course, has the sadness element to it, but it also has massive opportunity for self-growth, doesn't it? And for me, that's such a precious time.
Huge. I mean, it definitely, as I said before, it changed my life. It's changed my career. It's changed how I am in relationships with other people, changed what I do socially, absolutely everything, really. And that has been a good thing. But I also see how it can be very difficult. You know, it can be a very lonely time. And if it's not easy to find support systems out there sometimes, and it can feel, you know, life has fallen apart in some way, and rebuilding it can seem very scary. And it takes a lot of courage to sometimes pick up the pieces and keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. And that keeping going is important, isn't it? But particularly if you've got children. And particularly if you're having to try and keep things as stable and normal as you can for them. I'm just really conscious of the times, Paul, and it's been fascinating sort of having a dive into shame and guilt. But if you're listening to this as a person who feels a great sense of shame or has that guilt or whatever, what are your top tips for people? What would you like to leave people with in terms of how they navigate divorce and separation if those feelings of shame and guilt are overwhelming?
I would definitely advise writing letters, you know, those kind of ruminating thoughts that you're not going to send, you know, so you write them down, rip them up, you know, that kind of thing. So it's kind of getting this process out of your body. So it's not going to get rid of it, but it's going to be going somewhere. I would advise being around people. There's a kind of tendency to not be around people, but actually we need to be around others. If you can, join groups, you know, whether that's a therapy group or that's actually just a group of a hobby or something, so that you're around other people and trying to build that social part of your life again. And speaking to other people, it would be, it's tempting to not speak to others and think we're kind of burdening others, and particularly friends and family. I don't want to be going on about the divorce again, or don't want to be doing this, but actually is helpful.
I think, you know, as you say, anything you can do that builds your interactivity with people, or that you can find small ways to reward and treat yourself, they are the key things, aren't they? Just to building back that little bit of sense of self. Small things, isn't it? It doesn't have to be big, big things. It doesn't have to be buying a massage or going out and spending on your credit. It doesn't have to be anything like that. Just little tiny things.
Yeah,
an appreciation of something, isn't it, that just can, or a little self-affirmation, or just, I like doing the gratitude journal. So just at the end of the day, just one thing you're grateful for at the end of the day, or one thing you've achieved. It only has to be a small thing, but just to focus on the one thing you've achieved rather than the list of 10 things that you just didn't have time to do. But just flipping how we think about things as human beings, just the one little thing we did do, or the one positive thing that happened, they're the things that I think the more you focus on those things, the more you can build back your true sense of who you are and your strength.
And that's kind of actually, that speaks to that self-compassion. That is the building of the self-compassion. If you can just give yourself that credit for those little things and build that, and then it will build from there. So, yeah, definitely.
And also the other thing that I like is that critical voice in your head. That's not who you are. The fact that you can hear it means it's not you. It's a voice, and you don't have to listen to it. And your job in life is just to keep that in perspective and keep that at bay, I always think. That's not who you are. So those little nagging things are not who you are. You're a person beneath those, and you do have to screen some of that stuff out. It's been fascinating, you know, having the opportunity to talk to you, not just about your own experience, but, you know, what it's like when you're trying to help people and steer them through that emotional journey of relationship breakdown, divorce and separation. So thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find out a bit more about you?
So you can find out about me on my website, which is paulhuntingfordtherapy.com. And I'm offering one-to-one therapy and some groups as well.
Brilliant. And groups, it's like you say, it's worth just pointing out that groups can be a really useful tool, can't they, in terms of just helping people's experience of divorce and separation.
Definitely. And particularly actually with, in terms of shame, because it's, there's something about the group dynamic, which you're with people who are going through the same thing, and it can feel very isolated. Like you're the only one dealing with this problem, and you are the only one dealing with your version of the divorce. But actually being in a group with other people can lift some of that. And also, you know, I was talking about speaking with friends and family, you're speaking with other people who are going through it. So there's a bit of unburdening of that kind of responsibility from perhaps friends and family that sometimes we feel.
Well, we'll put the web address in the show notes as well, so people can look you up and find you online. And of course, you can find me. I'm on Twitter at Kate_Daly. You can hear more about new podcast episodes by following at divorce_podcast. And if you liked this podcast and want to subscribe for updates, you can do that by visiting thedivorcepodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you, Paul, too, for joining us.